a resort area, rented an apartment right on the beach, walked out there toward the Atlantic Ocean with his tripod, battery operated, transmitted 1 watt of power on 10 gigs, single sideband. Here I am, 380 miles away up on New York. His 3-degree beamwidth antenna was aimed at my 3-degree beamwidth antenna. My antenna was only a 2-foot dish on a 100-foot tower, and I'm transmitting 0.2 watts. His signal to me was about 30 dB above my noise, maybe 40, single sideband. From 380 miles away on 10 gigs, he sounded like he was in my backyard. That is super refraction. It was taking place at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a Sunday. He sounded like he was in my backyard. His signal was so strong, I think he could have doubled the distance between me and him on that day, and I would continue to talk to him. That kind of super refraction phenomena, you get that, let me drop. You get that kind of condition on 10 gigs fairly frequently. You don't get it on 432 megahertz. When you get to higher and higher frequencies, the atmosphere behaves differently. Different things bend the signal, if you know what I mean. So I know that the signal is getting to Florida every single year. Is it an hour per year? Is it 100 hours per year? It's time somebody run that experiment. I've got the hardware to do it. I've got the enthusiasm. To have a QSO on 10,000 megs with a guy in Florida and do it like I did with K4CAW. K4CAW, Al, in Greensboro, North Carolina, 480 miles from me. I talked to him on 432 megahertz sideband every Tuesday night from 7 to 7:30 for 4.5 years, summer, winter, spring, and fall. We just couldn't believe the signal would go that far. From the top of my tower, my radio horizon is 43 miles away. It's 480 miles airline distance from me. And as long as I'm using 16 Yagis on 432 on top of 100 feet of tower on my end, and 4 good Yagis on 100 feet of tower on his end, and a kilowatt of sideband on each end, we did it. Both running parallel kilowatt amplifiers, by the way. Strip line parallel kilowatt amplifiers. People up here to the north heard us doing that and said, these guys are running a hoax. They're only hearing one side of the conversation. They assume that we're on a telephone. Can you imagine the telephone call in 1978 to 1982 for a half hour every single Tuesday for 4.5 years? Can you imagine what that phone bill would be? Pretty soon there were guys midway between us in Washington, D.C., aiming their antennas to the north when I transmitted. I transmitted for the odd minutes. He transmitted for the even minutes. And the main part of the conversation is, what does the signal sound like during the last transmission? So guys midway listen to both sides of the conversation and say, hey, these guys are really doing it. This is not a hoax. And I guarantee you the same thing will happen again if I get a chance to run that experiment between here and Florida. I got to make sure I eat a lot of vegetables, very low cholesterol food, get a lot of sleep, a lot of exercise. I got to live long enough to carry out that experiment as I see it, Dan. I know this sounds crazy. AC2 LA, look what you could be doing. K2RIW in the TechNet. I heard a weak signal say question, but let me let Dan answer first. Go ahead, Dan. You ask the question. K2RIW.
Thanks, Dick. I think he answered the question, and it was pretty interesting, and a lot of super refraction, and big difference in how the radio waves at higher frequencies interact with the atmosphere, and very, very interesting stuff that you're doing. So thank you very much, and this is AC2LA, and I'll be listening.
Part of what's going on here, Dan, is that before the hardware is developed, before people start listening to higher frequencies over and over again over the last 100 years, history keeps repeating itself every 10 or 15 or 20 years. Back in the days of very beginning of broadcast, I think the year 1915 or so, the frequencies above 2 or 3 megacycles were considered useless. Nobody had built high-power broadcast transmitters up there. Those frequencies were given to ham radio operators because they thought that the signal would only travel by line of sight a few miles and it would die. And pretty soon the hams on 40 meters and 20 meters started talking tremendous distances. And you can read this in the book of 200 meters and down. I can't think of the name of the author right now. Somebody realized that when you go below 200 meters, which is below a couple of megacycles, there's a hell of a, above a couple of megacycles, there's a hell of a lot of these guys discovered the ionosphere, so to speak. So that scenario keeps getting repeated over and over again. The next higher band of frequencies where no one has ever gone, and they assume it's useless, the hams go there and say, wow, look how valuable this is. That keeps happening over and over again. The guys on 10 gigs started making this discovery. There was a little bit of a hint of this during World War II when some X-band weight radars were being discovered, and they suddenly realized that even from the low altitude of the periscope depth of the periscope of a submarine just barely above the sea could give you tremendous ranges at time, again because of super refraction. Over seawater, you got, as long as the wind isn't blowing too violently, you get this layer of high humidity air down low and dry humidity up top. The signal is bent downward. That's called super refraction, and tremendous ranges take place. So the hams keep rediscovering the next higher band that everyone thinks is useless is extremely valuable once you develop the right hardware and start using it. Somebody who had a question, who was that? Give me your call letters and name, K2RIW and the Tech Master. About 4 minutes ago, I did hear somebody say, question. Who was that?
Oh, that was Mike, K1MJM. Can you hear me?
I'm hearing you beautiful, Mike. Go right ahead with your question.
All right, I have two quick questions. One of them is, I assume that when you contacted the guy in Rodan, that was a prearranged communication. And the other one was, your dish on a 100-foot tower, is that...
Okay, a little bit of your conversation got cut off, but I'm going to wait now. Was it prearranged? Yes and no. All the guys on 10 gigs in New Jersey, there was the group called the KGB. They called themselves the KGB. And the KGB group, KGB stands for Climbing Gigahertz Brethren. And yes, they took the word K and misspelled it to be Climbing. Climbing Gigahertz Brethren is what they call themselves. So there's a group of roughly 10 guys in New Jersey that would meet at a restaurant every Wednesday during the week, and they knew that an entourage was being sent down to Rodan. I guess one of the guys was taking a vacation down there, so we knew he would be there that weekend. We knew that in the afternoon on Sunday, he's going to be aiming the antenna up north, picking up the guys in New Jersey, Long Island, Connecticut, wherever. So was it a prearranged schedule? Yes and no. All I knew was he was going to be that weekend, and I started listening. And let me think now, was it during a contest? During the contest, as you know, there was a 10 gigahertz contest in August and September every year. That's a kind of cross on a 10 gig band. It's a kind of cross banding in order to set up the contact. But once it's set up, all the information gets passed back and forth purely on 10 gigs. And by gentleman's agreement, that's a perfectly legal contact on that band, because you're trying to prove how the propagation works. It's different than the operator skill that's used on other bands, where in theory you're not supposed to use a telephone and so on. So that's the kind of prearrangement that we do, because when you're using a 3-degree beamwidth, you've got to aim it in the right direction, otherwise you're not likely to hear the guy. But what's amazing is that until recently, almost everybody on that band is running only hundreds of milliwatts, and sometimes only a couple of milliwatts. Very few people exceeded 1 watt in those days. Nowadays, there are more and more 10-watt solid-state transmitters coming along. But you and I know what QRP is, and when it comes to that band, because you can get easily 35 dB of gain out of a 2-foot diameter dish, as such, with all that antenna gain, you don't need anywhere near as much transmitter power. Is the good news. The bad news is you've got to use all kinds of intelligence to aim the dish in the right direction, or do a lot of switching back and forth in order to find the guy if you know he's somewhere out there, so to speak. I wonder if that answers some of your questions, Mike. And I'll warn you, Mike, you keep asking enough questions, you get enough of the enthusiasm the guys on 10 gigs have got. It's a drug. You'll get wrapped into this and you'll have a brand new hobby. There's 26 different kinds of ham radio, Mike. And you're going to be infected with this other one, so be careful. K1MJM, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I'm in the middle of it, tech kit. That's why I'm asking. The other part of my question was does wind affect the pointing accuracy of your antenna on the tower?
Okay, so you're building a Down East microwave kit, and they are very respected. That's a good way to get this. You're going to be on 10 gigs. And does the wind on the tower affect the aiming of the dish? Sort of yes and no. I was aiming the dish with a ratty old Ham-M rotator. With a Ham-M rotator, to aim it to the nearest 3 degrees in absolute accuracy is a good trick. And I had made myself a calibration chart. Also, I got very skilled with pressing the buttons on the controller so I could easily rock the antenna back and forth a couple of degrees. And I wasn't smart enough to wind balance the antenna. So on a windy day, did I get a little bit of wind caused QSB? A small amount. Not as much as you would think. If I was smart enough to put a weather vane behind the dish so that it's wind balanced, so the dish didn't tend to aim itself downwind on a windy day, I could even correct that. So don't let that be a showstopper, if you know what I mean, Mike. So wind aiming directions, minor problem. It's your major problem on 10 gigs, more than any other band you and I know about, is you gotta clear the trees. If your antenna clears the trees and you're talking to somebody, let me pick a number, 50 miles away, and he's gangbusters, and now you lower the antenna 20 feet so that it's below the tree line in your neighborhood, that signal will get 100 to 1, 1,000 to 1 weaker, 20 or 30 dB weaker because of the trees. You get tremendous foliage attenuation on 10 gigs. On 10 gigs, the leaves on the trees in the summertime are anechoic material. They suck up the RF. Let me drop. They suck up the RF and turn it into heat. Now, the trees can, in a left-handed manner, give you a benefit, because a buddy of mine, 10 miles away from me in Smithtown, I think it was, yes, Smithtown, was doing some... This guy, 10 miles away from me in Smithtown, was doing some testing in his backyard of his antenna. Pretty soon I got him on the telephone and said, hey, Bruce, I'm hearing you. And Bruce says, how is that possible? I've got 60-foot high trees in the backyard. I'm down at the lawn level running an experiment, and I'm transmitting a couple of milliwatts of power out of a signal generator in order to measure the pattern on his antenna. And he says, you can't possibly be hearing me. And I said, I am hearing you. Turn that signal generator on and off, and I'll tell you when. And I did. He said, wow. What we discovered is that the signal from my tower was skipping across the tops of the trees, and then when it got to his backyard, that tree that was right at the edge of his backyard got that signal, deflected it downward, scattered it into his backyard, and that's how he heard me, and I heard him. 10 miles away, way below tree level, we never thought that, I guess you could call that treetop propagation. Another experiment we ran once with the guys were at Mount Mitchell in New Jersey, which is very close to Sandy Hook, I think it is. If they aimed their antennas dead north at the World Trade Center when it was there, and I aimed my antenna dead west for the World Trade Center, reflecting off the World Trade Center, we got a signal tremendously louder than we aimed directly at each other. Building bounce mode is another thing you can do on 10 gigs. And rain scatter mode, you'd be amazed how well rain will scatter on 10 gigs because the droplet size is starting to approach the wavelength. Look out, Mike, you're going to get infected. K1FJM, K2RIW, and the Tech Man.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Chris. Everything, that's excellent info. Great, thank you very much. And like I said, I do have a kit. I'm working on that kit. And I'll be in touch. Once again, thank you, Chris. K1FJM, listening.
Very fine, Mike. Do check in with us periodically as you get that Down East Microwave 10 gig kit together, get it operational. And whether your first transmission is done with a simple horn, a parabolic dish, and don't fall into the trap, Mike. Lots of guys in the beginning think that, hey, if a 1 foot dish has got this gain, a 2 foot dish has got that gain, a 3 foot dish has got that gain, then they say, oh, gee, why don't I use a 3 or 4 foot dish? Be careful. It's very similar to when you buy your first telescope. A person who's naive wants to buy his first telescope, and he looks at the advertisement, and the manufacturer on this 2 foot, on this 2 inch diameter telescope says it's got a gain of 500. Oh boy. A 2 inch diameter scope, you use more than 120 gain, 60 times the number of inches, more than 120 gain, and you've got a fuzzy picture. So it may have great sounding advertisement because it's got a whole lot of gain, this tiny little telescope, but it really is a farce, if you know what I mean. So by the same token, don't fall into the trap thinking that your first dish has got to be 3 foot in diameter or above. Two is more than enough in the beginning because you're trading off a little bit of extra gain and a hell of a lot more difficulty of keeping the tripod up on a windy day where it doesn't blow over and damage your equipment. The bigger dish will give you more grief. It's got a hell of a lot more difficult aiming characteristic. You're better off starting off with the horn or a 2 foot dish, in my opinion. So don't fall into that trap. Other than that, you're going to enjoy yourself on that band. You'll get a real kick out of having either a beacon transmitter a small distance away, or somebody is giving you a key down signal, and you wave your hand in front of the dish, and you'll hear the Doppler shift of that 10 gig signal reflecting off your moving hand. And you do that. Let me drop. You'll do that, and you'll say, wow, that's a very interesting piece of physics. That's something you can't do on the lower hand bands. On 10 gigs, you wave your hand, and you'll hear a burp, burp, burp sign every time your hand moves a half a wavelength, which is a half an inch. Every time you move half an inch, it goes through another peak and valley of signal strength of reflection, cophase and antiphase. So you wave your hand rapidly, and you hear the rumbling sound of Doppler shift of the 10 gig signal reflecting off your hand when you wave it in front of the dish. It's just one of the many experiments you can do. And the first time you hear rain scatter, snow scatter, that will be very exciting to you. It is the 10 gig equivalent to aurora propagation. It sounds like aurora. You don't get very much single sideband intelligibility out of rain scatter, but it gives you a beautiful CW signal. But the tone gets spread out in a funny way. Instead of the normal tone, when you're sending out CQ and you're hearing the guy by rain scatter, I'll give you an example of there was a mountain between me and a guy in the Boston area, and we didn't stand a chance. But to the west of him, there was a rain cloud one day. We both aimed at that rain cloud, and I could easily hear his signal as a reflection, even though he's behind the mountain as far as I'm concerned. And when he's sending Morse code and you're hearing the reflection off that cloud, it sounded like it almost had no tone. As you tuned the receiver across that signal, you would hear the zero beat of a signal that's spread out in frequency because of the individual Doppler shifts of the individual velocities of the individual water molecules that are doing the reflection in that rain cloud. K1FJM, K2RIW in the tech net.
Roger that. Again, thank you very much. This is all great information. I can't wait to get started. I do have a couple of dishes that I picked out. I have a small dish. I live here at Right to the Path. Got a couple of small dishes. And I think I'm all set. I'm getting close. K1FJM, back over to you. Thank you again.
When you say you've got a couple of small dishes, roughly what diameter are you talking about?
One is, I believe, 8 inches, the other 24 inches approximately.
Beautiful. Yeah, the 18-inch DSS satellite dish does a beautiful job, offset-fed dish. And offset-fed is a lot more desirable on 10 gigs than prime-fed. So your 18-inch or your 24-inch, that's just the right size. With a good sturdy tripod and portable electronics, battery operated, that'll work like a charm. I did an awful lot of my 10 gig operation from home on the top of the tower. I put a box behind the dish on the top of the tower, and the transverter was in that box. I would send a 144 megacycle signal up the cable. The box and the converter would convert that to 10 gigs and transmit it. On reception, the transverter in the box would take the signal off the dish, mix it down to 144, and it came back down that same cable, and I listened to it in the shack on the tunable receiver. This very receiver, Kenwood 711, for instance. So a remotely tuned, tunable IF, and to send the signal up 100 foot of power on 10 gigs would give me a hell of a lot of loss. But to send only 144 megs and let all the transmitting and reception take place at the top of the tower works like a charm. However, if I go the next step, and I've got this great big power supply, traveling wave tube, and 200-watt amplifier, can I put that 200-watt traveling wave tube in its power supply, can I put that at the top of the tower? Probably not. That would be a little too heroic. And that's where the periscope antenna system comes along, because that's the one kind of feed line that has no loss, so to speak, and now everything can be in the shack with me. Have you ever heard the word periscope antenna system before, Mike? K1MJM, K2RIW?
Roger that, I have. Yes, I have.
Okay, so you have heard about a periscope antenna system. Somebody doesn't know about that. These were very popular, 20 or so years ago, as commercial installations on microwave towers. It consists of a parabolic dish at the bottom of the tower aimed straight up in the air. At the top of the tower, you've got this reflector, a piece of metal, a fly swatter at a 45-degree angle to the ground. So the signal from the dish goes up to the tower, reflects off that fly swatter, and goes out into space. That's called a periscope antenna system because radio-wise, it's just like an optical periscope that you would use as a child with two mirrors, if you know what I mean, inside of a tube. And that beam waveguide, the signal going from the bottom dish up to the fly swatter, has essentially no loss. There is no transmission line lower in loss than that beam waveguide. And when you set it up correctly, you can actually get a little bit of extra gain out of that system compared to what you think the dish is going to give you if the dish was at the top of the tower. So a very efficient system. And now as a ham radio operator, if you go the next step, where that fly swatter on the top of the tower can be steered in azimuth for sure, elevation maybe, you now have got a radio telescope where you can aim at any celestial object you want to. And boy, can that be a lot of fun. Just listening to the sun noise on 10 gigs with your dish. And by the way, that's a lot of ways that, guys will, they get to a mountaintop, they know exactly what hour of the day it is. Let me drop. Therefore, with a very simple program, you can calculate where the sun is supposed to be on that day of the year, when you're at that latitude and longitude. Where should the sun be in azimuth and elevation? And you aim at the sun with your 10-gig dish, and you peek up on sun noise. And now you're peeking up, you're doing a better job than just doing optical peeking, like a gun sight on a rifle, so to speak. Radio-wise, you're peeking up on the sun. And how much sun noise you get tells you what the sensitivity of your receiver, also tells you something about what the sun is doing. And now you know the exact azimuth, so to speak, and you can calibrate your compass rose. You can calibrate your compass rose that you've got on the tripod. You know where to aim from then on. So It's a different, very different kind of ham radio, as you can tell. Okay, I wonder if any of you guys have got any further questions. If not, we'll start closing down. K2LIW, listening, TechNet. Anybody got any further questions or comments on any subject, give me a call. That is right now.
Science to discovery, they bounce it all around. Back to you, Dick.
Okay. Although we don't know the name yet, John, of the show. Looks like you want to be watching the Science Channel. Because I don't have cable television, I only watch over-the-air television broadcast. I miss some of these things. Oh, well. But eventually they appear on websites. Wes, I think you had a question. WS2N, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Am I being, going out through that noise, well?
Yes, you are. We're hearing you very well. There's a way I can hear you on the input, Wes. WS2N, you're getting through, KQRIW.
Okay, enter again. Actually, the theory about the collision is pretty much known, and, there was a theory study that Earth and the Moon created as a result of giant collision between two planets of the size of Mars or Venus. And it is thought that it happened 4.537 million years ago. That would be 4 million years ago and a change. It was then thought that the planets split and the part of the two planets created the Earth, and one that was ripped off went by inertia but didn't have too much force to go out of the magnetic field or the gravity field of the Earth. Let me just. At the same time, when I heard about it, I was able to get the information about the dating using radioactive elements, and they have been using a hafnium-182, which was used to date the age of the collision, or say. One of the things that I have noticed is that the reason that most likely people don't go to Moon any longer is because they didn't find anything special over there. It's more like Earth, chemical substance of it. But there is one thing that might have put away a big power with the big man of it. Moon has all of the precious metals. So we're talking about all the radioactive metal, but at the same time gold, platinum, and plenty of others. So by being able to create a part and driving the technology to be more affordable to be on the Moon, they would actually ruin the monetary system of the Earth, and that's what some of them were, I believe, most of afraid for. Because if there is a part of the Earth, anyhow, there is nothing new on it. Let me just. There is, however, another thing that if you had a chance to read that, or our space experts that have a chance to read that, I spoke about it with my friend John. It is a pretty much nice article by NASA, National Aeronautics Space Administration. It actually shows how the cosmos or the universe looks like from the perspective of gamma rays. And that is absolutely magnificent material. I believe John and I even sent it to Glenn out as well, so all of you guys, so the space expert, you would be able to say something about it. Chum, pick up, please.
We heard everything, Wesley. Very good. I think Dick's about to pick it up, but yeah, I think that's one of the websites you sent.
What would you think?
One of the YouTube. That was very good. Very, very good. I like that one. I think I answered that. But,
Dick is back.
Yeah, Dick is back. And John, Wes had passed it over to you to comment on whether you had seen the material he's now describing, which I think is gamma ray photography, as I believe is the subject. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the group, and the tech man.
Dick, I only gave that a cursory view. I didn't really do any major reading there. I thought it was a video, but it was not. It was just several pages of written explanations and public drawings. Nothing that thrilled me.
Okay, John. That came through very well. So it didn't thrill you. The Hafnium 182, the gating system. Not quite sure I know about that. Now, was that used as a dating system at the time of the event? In other words, you dig to the right level on Earth, and you look for that to give you information about the Mars-sized object that impacted with the Earth, or was that dating system used on the soil that was returned from the Moon? One other comment I'm going to make, Wes, and that is, to say that the Moon is too similar to the Earth and that's why we didn't go back, that may be one reason. Another reason is that the Apollo program was $32 billion, a lot of risk involved, and to maintain an astronaut in a spacesuit on the Moon for an extended period of time is a pretty heroic effort and it's kind of expensive. Yeah, by modern techniques we can do it better and maybe a little cheaper now, but there's a cost restriction, and I think Congress will very rapidly ask the question, okay, if we spend another $30 billion going to the Moon, what do we get in return? And that answer is not so easy to answer. You take a small fraction of that number of dollars and invest it into the International Space Station, and they think they're getting a bigger bang for the dollar. That's a guess on my part. In 2XJM.
The age of the Earth and the Moon can be dated by examining the presence of certain elements in the Earth mantle. And the Hafnium 182 is radioactive substance which decays and then is converted into the isotope of tungsten 182, which is natural decaying. When you have a matter that is decaying, it is a massive manifestation of a lack of stability, and then it decays to a different kind of element. Let me drop. And the two elements could be marked with different chemical properties, so why the tungsten isotope prefers to bond with the metal, hafnium prefers to bind with silicates, which would be then the rock. So let me take the samples of the rock of the our satellite, the biggest satellite, right? Moon. And we have a ability to measure the half-life. The half-life roughly is if you have 100 atoms of any given substance, when 50% of those atoms decay, that means they are not no longer radioactive, they're in steady form. Of course, that steady form would belong to different elements that could be isotope of the previous element, but not necessarily radioactive, or different matter. So let's say the hafnium, you've got the tungsten, let me drop. Of that matter is already stable, then we talk about the half-life. And in the methodology of measuring how old is whatever, there was another one which was the carbon-14 that was used, but at this point they decided to go to hafnium-182. When we go to the article that I have sent, which was the NASA article, how the world looks like when we look at it from the perspective of gamma ray, we got to understand that there is a spectrum of the electromagnetic waves where gamma ray is just the part of it. So when we look at that, we see the radio, infrared, visible, ultraviolet, X-ray, gamma ray, particles, but then we have a mass containing particles and those would be the beta and alpha. By the concept, it is said, which I completely disagree, that radio waves are completely harmless to the organic matter or to the organism or to the matter not interacting with the matter. Whether the one frequency that would be then questionable would be infrared, which is not far from the radio wave, is the next chapter up towards the shorter and shorter frequencies. And that article that I gave, for the first time I've seen in my life, the article which says about how much do we penetration of different wavelengths of the radio wave towards the atmosphere. And what's happened? The radio wave goes without any problem and we reaches the surface. So we roughly take the 500 kilometers of the space between the Earth and the space. The radio wave goes without no problem. The infrared, which is a spectrum, is not one frequency only. It goes to approximately as close to the Earth as 12 to 15 kilometers. Whether visible light and visible light is higher in the frequency and shorter in the wavelength than the infrared, and this one doesn't have a problem to reach the surface and we can see. And then we have a different color of it, which represents different frequencies. By the concept infrared states that it's able to excite, to make the metal vibrate. So infrared with the high intensity can make a vibration of the metal. Visible light is set, so it doesn't, it's harmless. Then we have ultraviolet, and ultraviolet we say is, wow, it's dangerous. How are you correct with that? If you look at the map that was in that article for NASA, we have a ultraviolet as the frequency wave that is the least penetrable to the atmosphere. That means that we have a 500 kilometers of space and between the Earth and the space, and the ultraviolet could only go as close as 100 kilometers from the Earth structure. Although, you gotta understand that this is a spectrum. So within that spectrum, you could have a one particle frequency of ultraviolet that could go as close as 50 kilometers. Somebody would say, well, we have all of the screens protecting us from ultraviolet whatsoever. Baloney, DF. What we have, yes, we have a presence of individual photons. Yes, we can have a cancer. Yes, we could. So it depends on the sensitivity of somebody's skin, somebody's body. But I rather see that as the commercial that is actually pushing people to, if you want to have a nice skin without the risk of the cancer, buy this. If you want to protect yourself from the cancer, buy this. And whatsoever, whatsoever. And then, it is said that ultraviolet is able to excite the matter. Exciting the matter. Excitation of the matter means that it is a temporary fusion of two atoms. They stay always in their orbit, but they have been temporarily fused. You write two atoms, one next to the other, and then you put one envelope on it, which would be oval. Then we have the X-ray. And the X-ray, based on the NASA articles, could go a little bit deeper than ultraviolet goes. And that would be about 80 to 70 kilometers close to the distance between the Earth and the space. That's great. You see me on next field. Nightmare is able to break the perpendicular line. The thing is that we can rip off the atom that put his excellent. And then you have a gamma ray. Now the beauty of the gamma ray is that first the gamma ray quantum here. Actually has a small cylinder. And then when you put it at the center of the fountain, that applies you to give a square law of the distance, which would then give you the strength for the density. It is not dangerous, or X-ray, or other virus that is dangerous, to the sum up of the distance. What is the concentration of? And that you can measure by the square centimeter or the square of the cubic inch. Cubic we don't know, but a special triangular name of measure. So it would be so far that's it, and then if you don't mind, we have nothing to talk about it, I can go play how the universe looks like, how the sun looks like when using gamma ray. And the gamma ray is not a photography, it's a spectroscopy. The spectroscopy stands about analysis of the gamma ray spectrum and being able to create an image. So we are not talking about the photography, but we're talking about the imaging, which is very much related to the photography, and we can make a movie out of it. It's beautiful.
One of the subjects you discussed, I'm not coming through so well right now. Stand by. One of the subjects you discussed was RF energy, how much it penetrates into a human being, radio frequency, biohazard, and although you can look at the depth of penetration at various frequencies, and that could become alarming, the American National Standards Institute, the so-called C95 report, which represents 65 years of research on that subject, and it's got close to 1,000 references. It's got the best testing laboratories, the best universities, organizations that can do those kind of measurements. Of course, knowledge, they haven't found anything but a thermal effect, heat effect. RF energy, when it hits the human being, only creates heat. And as long as you keep it below a reasonable amount of heat, like 1 or 2 degrees Fahrenheit, let me drop. As long as you keep it below a couple of degrees of Fahrenheit of heating, then, to my knowledge, there is almost no permanent effect. During the heating, you get some kind of an effect, but no permanent effect. I'll admit that if you are exposed to an amount of RF energy 24 hours a day that created 1 or 2 degrees of Fahrenheit rise in temperature, and you did that day in and day out for weeks on end, guaranteed it would be a deleterious effect. But almost nobody does that. Nobody's going to be exposed to that amount of RF energy for that length of time. Oh, I guess it's possible if you live directly next door to a broadcast station. You could come close to that, although the broadcast stations you can get close to would be AM, and the AM signal has very little absorption. Most of it goes straight. So as I see it, Wes, the total amount of damage a human being suffers from reasonable amounts of radio exposure seems to be more alarming than reality. To my knowledge, they've done lots and lots of testing. I don't think they've measured anything but the thermal effect. Are you familiar with any radio exposure experiment where anything beyond the thermal effect was measured as a permanent change to the human being? Are you familiar with any articles that say that? And if you are, my next question is going to be, was that experiment duplicated in any other laboratory Was it peer-reviewed? Was it reviewed by other people that could duplicate the experiment and find out if it was valid? N2XAN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Wes.
Big CN. Well, we're shifting from the original subject of the discussion, and I would say that so far, official physics states that radio waves are non-harmful to the organic matter, and that's what is happening. We may have two approaches to it. One of the approaches would be then that it is really what is being explained, and the other one is that it is what is convenient. I remember when I was young, and there was a guy working on the radar disc, which is also electromagnetic wave. He was actually fried, and yes, he could be fried because of the raising of cell temperature. But then we're talking about interaction of the photons with the organic body, and the photon doesn't have a mass, so we're talking about the energy interacting with the organic body. But despite the same token, we could say that the photon could interact with the body. Okay, so still is being proven beyond the reasonable doubt what I believe I would be able to prove. As silly as it sounds, I strongly believe that I would be the one that would be able to prove. Yes, radio waves of 300, 400, 100 megahertz. Is able to create matter, steady matter, not radioactive matter, decays. And that's what I'm trying to experiment with, non-radioactive matter. And if I don't have any results, there is no change at all. You guys are going to be living the way that you're going to be living. And we'll see what's up to 3 months. But if I were to be able to prove that we have a certain component of the electromagnetic spectrum that is manifested by unsteady matter that used to be steady and must be steady by the laws of the physics, tell me something about different story. And I'm going to then ask you Dick, to come to my place, and I'm going to show it to you. Enjoy here.
Wes, would I be correct in assuming that you've recently purchased some new test equipment which is capable of making nuclear measurements, in other words, of radiation measurements, maybe even a radiation spectrometer. I'm not using the right word, but I think you know what I mean. A spectrum analyzer of radiation, in other words, the number of particles and the energy of those particles. I think you've recently possibly acquired some new test equipment to do that. Am I correct in that guess? N2XJN, K2RIW.
Much coordinate is being done at first because the pen is to pay, because nobody wants it. All the people around the city are unaware of the fact that there is a transfer of traffic to display the region. Also, the reason for the general public is not here. And the reason for that is because there is a nuclear hysteria where nuclear magnetic resonance was remaining MRI. That is not here in this world. So, it is very much sad and very much not optimistic that when we have the basic development of the city of the city, the United States is not able to say something wrong. I'm going to take you to the city of the city of the city, and you're going to see the level of radioactivity exceeding an alarm level for most of the spectrometers. So we're going to the state at which the general public is being pushed to the shadow in this area, especially because it's very much inconvenient. Why do they need to know that if you have a tree element, which would be hydrogen, tritium, and deuterium, the two others could be perfectly good for creating electricity or the energy. There was an American experiment that was done in the 50s and 60s, and it was working properly to close the plant. What is the reason for breeding money? But that's my personal opinion, and I'm entitled to it. So, what I'm saying is, it is not that I believe that I am not mistaken by my senses, and I would be able to prove that radioactive, that non-radioactive matter could become decaying by the impact of the electromagnetic waves. That was the original 1956 Coleman experiment, and he was able to prove that and produce electricity out of it. But we're not talking about producing electricity out of it. We're talking about the guy who says, okay, there is no radiation at all. I don't have to be afraid. I have a gamma spectroscopy. I have a beta spectroscopy. The gamma spectroscopy cost me $60. That was purchased because some of the people are too stupid to know what is the value of it. That particular institution spent probably about $500,000 for that. But the problem is that 2,200 pounds, and it's inconvenient to cut it out from the facility. That thing will allow me to see an electron inhalation effect. An electron inhalation effect is actually when the electron is being pulled into the nuclei and then creates an extra neutron at that time, where the two particles that are emitted from the nuclei, and that would be positron, which would be the beta blast, which is an antiparticle of the electron, exactly the size of electron. Another particle that we have is neutrino, and neutrino, because the small particle, along with a positron, will fly away from the nucleus with very high speed. But the problem is that because a positron has the same mass as an electron that is on the orbit, on each way where the electron is flying out from the nuclei, it is most likely hitting an orbital electron, and then those two particles as a mass particles destroy themselves completely, creating two gamma photons at 180 degrees apart. But this gamma spectroscopy device that I have, this is not the only one, I have two of them, is simply able to see that 180 degrees two photons, which does have a scintillating their phase photo multiplier, which then are the signal is being sent to the free of charge open source program, pretty much a beautiful one. Is much more specialized than I am, and that would be one of the reasons to teach that. Somebody say, I don't teach. But then if you don't teach, another thing is, how about if I save the people? And just for that, there are devices that feed an image, and it will be real image in lifetime of whatever is going on the spectrum of the light or the electromagnetic waves. That would actually show it to you. This is another part of the knowledge which is pretty much exciting, where actually the gamma ray go to the crystal. The crystal is the atoms in the crystal are being excited. And the crystal is or could be our salt, kitchen salt, sodium iodide with some of the addition on it. Then it creates a micro explosion in it that will create a photon. This is a photon that is called photon, those are photo multiplier. And of the photo multiplier, we have a very much a amplified signal that goes to the phosphorus screen. And the phosphorus screen is the phosphorus screen that was. So it allows them to the picture. Now you have a regular PCD camera that could see a dead picture, and then give you ability to connect it to the BNC connector that's seen on the screen. That's one of the ways of doing it.